This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Pete's Coffee and Tea, deep roasting and blending coffee beans since 1966, Pete's.com or 800-999-2132.
My name is Lisa Loving. I'm the Evening News and Public Affairs Director. Our KBOO network drive melted down today. We tried to put out a locally produced broadcast, but we will be back tomorrow with new equipment and a real handmade broadcast. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News, followed by selected pieces of Democracy Now! Thank you for your patience.
This is Free Speech Radio News. It's Thursday, June 8th, 2006. From KPFA in Berkeley, I'm Brian Edwards-Tickert, sitting in for Aldo Bogado. A U.S. airstrike kills al-Qaeda in Iraq leader Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. House Democrats make a last-ditch effort to preserve internet neutrality. And a commission on America's prisons delivers a scathing assessment to a Senate committee.
We have to understand that there are consequences to how we treat them inside for what happens on the outside.
These stories and more, but first, these headlines.
From Pacifica Station WBAI New York, I'm Mitch Jeserich with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. After weeks of wrangling, the Iraqi Assembly today overwhelmingly approved Prime Minister Nouri Maliki's nominees to fill the post to head the Defense and Interior Ministries. Jawad Boulani, who is a Shiite, will be the new Interior Minister, and Abdul Qadir Obeidi, who is a Sunni, will head the Defense Ministry. Filling the positions is seen as vital towards the development of a unity government. Also, it was announced today that a U.S. airstrike killed the alleged al-Qaeda leader in Iraq, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. We'll have more on that story coming up. The Republican chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Arlen Specter, is accusing Vice President Dick Cheney of working with the other Republicans on his committee from keeping the committee from issuing subpoenas to Bell South, Verizon, and AT&T concerning their involvement of a controversial NSA surveillance program. Senator Patrick Leahy is the ranking Democrat on the committee.
We're preparing in the Judiciary Committee to subpoena some of the telephone companies to ask why they were doing. Actually, we wanted to subpoena the one that said they didn't do it and why, what they were told. And you know what happened? We were told, well, Vice President Cheney said he'd look into it and he'd report back to one of the senators on the committee and let them know everything was okay. This is not oversight.
Cheney has responded by saying that advising lawmakers is not an unusual thing for a vice president to do. The row between a top U.N. official and U.S. ambassador to the U.N., John Bolton, continues to deepen. Bolton is demanding an apology from Deputy Secretary General Mark Mollock Brown, who has accused the U.S. of undermining the importance of the United Nations.
To have the Deputy Secretary General criticize the United States in such a manner can only do grave harm to the United Nations.
Bolton has not received an apology. Brown says his comments were meant in an attempt to strengthen the UN.
These are issues that for those of us trying to steer this ship, the UN, towards safe harbor, you know, we have to speak to these very threatening storms that surround this organization.
A spokesperson for the UN General Secretary Kofi Annan says that Annan supports his deputy, saying he agreed with the thrust of Brown's speech. The worst violators of labor union rights after Colombia are multinational companies. That's according to the International Confederation of Free Trade Unions in a report released today. Naomi Fowler has more.
The Brussels-based International Confederation of Free Trade Unions annual survey on trade union rights violations said today that while Colombia is still the most dangerous country in the world to be a trade unionist, multinational companies follow hot on its heels in terms of union rights violations. The figures for South American countries like Brazil and Honduras remain particularly high. The report identifies other obstacles to union rights like the rise of informal economies, lack of commitment of governments and industrial tribunals to ensure respect of labour legislation, and also the huge increase in insecure employment contracts that can be the result of deregulation and increased liberalisation. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
A strike has been called in the Indian-administered Kashmir in protest of the arrest of a prominent hardline Kashmiri separatist. Shahnawaz Khan reports.
Gilani was arrested in Poonch district of Jammu and Kashmir on Wednesday the area he was touring since June 2nd. Gilani has been charged with inciting communalism and working against the country. The arrest warrant against Gilani had been issued 5 years ago in Poonch. A firebrand leader, Gilani has stayed away from dialogue process with India, calling it futile. In Kashmir's summer capital of Srinagar, supporters of Gilani came out in protest against the arrest. All parties Hurriyat Conference has called for a shutdown strike in Kashmir on Friday. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Shahnawaz Khan.
Social tension is on the rise just weeks ahead of Mexico's presidential elections. The death toll from the violent police raid of the town of Atenco rose yesterday when a 20-year-old university student died from a severe head wound caused by a police tear gas grenade. The student, Alexis Benumea, had spent more than 30 days in a coma. A commission from Amnesty International is scheduled to visit Atenco today to investigate claims of extreme police misconduct and abuse during last month's raid of the town. A federal appeals court has overturned a lower court's decision to temporarily stay the execution of accused murderer Percy Walton, who is scheduled to die tonight in Virginia. Walton's execution was originally stayed by a lower court that said his execution should be postponed until the U.S. Supreme Court rules on a separate case looking at the constitutionality of lethal injections. Walton's lawyers also claim that he is insane. Percy Walton is scheduled to be executed at 9 p.m. Eastern tonight. And those are some of the news headlines. I'm Mitch Jezrich with Free Speech Radio News.
The U.S. military announced this morning that an overnight military airstrike had killed Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq. The Bush administration simultaneously congratulated itself on the killing and downplayed its importance. President Bush said there will be tough days ahead in Iraq. FSRN's Aaron Glantz and Salam Talib have more.
Arguably, over the last several years, no single person on this planet has had the blood of more innocent men, women, and children on his hands than Zarqawi. He personified the dark, sadistic, and medieval vision of the future of beheadings and suicide bombings and indiscriminate killings.
Secretary of State Donald Rumsfeld joined a chorus of Bush administration officials celebrating the killing of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. Iraq's Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki joined in, adding, "Those who disrupt the course of life, like Zarqawi, will have a tragic end." Maliki's comments were echoed by Fadl al-Shara, spokesman for the Shiite cleric Muqtada Sadr, who has led two armed rebellions against the Anglo-American occupation and regularly calls for its demise.
After this, the terrorism will be reduced. The terrorists now know what their future is, and their future is they will be killed just like Zarqawi. It's time for everyone to rally around the Iraqi government. The terrorism will end, and we will have an Iraq without dictatorship, without problems, and with stability.
But not everyone shares this optimism. Though Zarqawi was almost universally reviled in Iraq, he was not a central figure in the insurgency. That, according to the spokesman for the Sunni Clerics Group, the Association of Muslim Scholars, Muthanna Adhari.
The issue is not the capture of Zarqawi. It's not related to one person. It's that the occupation wants to destroy anyone that's resisting them, armed group and political groups alike. This arrest is meant to hide the fact that the occupation is not meant to help Iraqi people.
Adhari's father, Harith Adhari, is imam of a mosque near Abu Ghraib prison that has been a center of anti-American rhetoric. He once issued a fatwa against any Iraqi helping the U.S. or British militaries and spoke of armed resistance as a religious duty. The Association of Muslim Scholars has since tempered that rhetoric, participated in Iraqi elections, and joined the new unity government. But Muthanna Adhari tells Free Speech Radio News policies that are causing resentment and anger against Iraqis continue, including the incarceration of more than 15,000 Iraqis without trial at American prisons. The Iraqi government announced this week they had reached an agreement with Washington to release about 2,500 prisoners. But Adhari says that won't be enough to bring peace.
We want them to release them, and we don't want them to just replace them with new detainees. They are taking people out, and at the same time, they are bringing new people in.
Azhari also speculated Iraqi prisoners are only being released because the U.S. military is planning on arresting more people, and they have run out of space in their existing prisons. The U.S. military has moved 1,500 troops to the edge of the western Iraqi city of Ramadi. President Bush.
We have tough days ahead of us in Iraq that will require the continued patience of the American people. Yet the developments of the last 24 hours give us renewed confidence in the final outcome of this struggle, the defeat of terrorism threats, and a more peaceful world for our children and grandchildren.
Administration officials said today Zarqawi's killing does not mean that any of the 135,000 U.S. troops in Iraq will be coming home soon. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz with Salam Talib.
In the face of a massive lobbying and advertising campaign financed by the telecom industry, the House of Representatives is set to vote on a last-ditch attempt to maintain internet neutrality. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports from Capitol Hill.
The telecommunications bill would decrease government regulations and allow telephone companies to enter into the cable business. But the issue of net neutrality has become a major topic of this debate. Critics fear that net neutrality will be lost, which has prompted odd coalitions in the House of Representatives, one being Liberal Democrats John Conyers from Michigan, Edward Markey from Massachusetts, and staunch conservative James Sensenbrenner from Wisconsin. Representative Markey.
Net neutrality, an issue which is going to fundamentally change the nature of the Internet forever.
Net neutrality provides all Internet users with equal access to all information on the Internet. Ben Scott is Government Affairs Director of Free Press. He talks about what would happen if there was no net neutrality.
They'll put the word out to all the content providers, everybody from Joe Blogger to Pacifica Radio up to Google and Amazon, that anybody who wants to have a guaranteed quality of service is going to have to ante up and come to the table and make a special deal with the network operator. And if you've got listeners all over the country who are listening over the Internet, you're going to have to make a special deal with every single operator, with AT&T, with Verizon, with Comcast, with Time Warner, and that's going to cost a huge amount of money. And a lot of organizations that are currently providing alternative media, that are currently providing a diverse set of voices in the online public sphere, will be shut out.
Representative Markey has offered an amendment that allows the government to ensure that the Internet would remain open. Search engines such as Google and Microsoft support net neutrality that has pitted them against the telephone and cable company industry. And the debate on the issue has been an expensive one.
We must update our telecom laws to encourage market-based competition.
Ads such as this by the telecommunications industry have been airing on TV across the country. According to Arlen Communications, a research group, nearly $1 million has been spent on advertising each week in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area alone. And that's from just mid-April to mid-May. And 85% of that was spent by the telecom industry. They say net neutrality is a side issue of the larger bill and that Markey's amendment is premature and unnecessary. Walter McCormick is the president and CEO of U.S. Telecom Association. He has faith the FCC will regulate appropriately.
The chairman of the FCC has indicated that he has authority to act and will act should any company block, impair, or degrade consumers' access to any website. We believe that Congress has sufficient problems to address without trying to address what-if scenarios or hypotheticals. Should a problem arise, the FCC will address it.
The telecom industry has increased its lobbying dollars from $5 million 10 years ago to $17 million just 2 years ago. The American Library Association is also active in the campaign. They support net neutrality and the Markey Amendment. Lynn Bradley is with the ALA.
This is something that libraries have worked on long before the Internet. It's a basic principle of librarianship. It's a very committed kind of activity for libraries to make sure that we have diverse sources of information, that the end user gets to select not just, you know, corporate interests or those who can afford to pay.
Opponents say the future of the Internet is bleak if this is ever implemented. Again, Ben Scott.
Quite frankly, you know, the Internet will start to look more and more like cable TV, where there will be a certain number of sites operated by deep-pocketed corporations that have made special deals with the big corporations who own the networks, and those sites will run head and shoulders better than any other site on the Internet.
The House will vote for the measure tomorrow. The Senate will debate this issue in the next few months with Senator John Ensign from Nevada, a lead opponent of net neutrality. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Chilean President Michelle Bachelet is in Washington for an official visit with U.S. President George W. Bush. Bachelet's visit is clouded by reports in the Chilean press that the U.S. State Department is pressuring Chile to join a group of Latin American countries to isolate Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez and block Chavez's bid to join the U.N. Security Council later this year. From Santiago, FSRN's Jorge Garretón reports.
According to a report in La Tercera, a Santiago daily, the U.S. government may have pressured officials in Chile to stop Venezuela from gaining greater South American influence. The article says that Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and Undersecretary Robert Solik told Chile's foreign minister to join Washington's efforts in isolating Venezuela's Chavez. And the report says if Chile did not comply, then the bilateral U.S. free trade agreement would face serious consequences. The news was quickly denied by U.S. and Chile's government spokesman, Ricardo Lagos Weber. Despite denials of the reported political pressures, none of the other events described in the story have been contested by the foreign minister nor the government. President Michelle Bachelet was asked about Chile's agenda in Washington in light of the report in La Tercera. She said she does not like being told what to do.
Chile has never allowed undue pressures. This president may have many flaws, but one it doesn't have is being faint-hearted. I have never allowed undue pressures. If there are legitimate requests that I find credible, then I accept them wholeheartedly. But undue pressure, I have never accepted them in the past, present, nor will I tolerate them in the future.
She added that Chile voted in the Security Council against the war in Iraq while Santiago was negotiating a free trade agreement with Washington. But Bachelet may have to tread carefully before saying yes or no. The U.S. also wants Chile's help searching for another Latin American candidate to occupy the non-permanent seat in the U.N. Security Council, a candidate that is not Venezuela. Meanwhile, Chile faces strategic energy needs, and Venezuela has pledged to meet Chile's growing energy demand for the next 50 years. Chile also has designs on buying gas from Bolivia and joins with Venezuela, Brazil, and Argentina in financing the so-called South America Energy Ring. University of Chile political scientist Guillermo Holzman says Chile is navigating in potentially rocky waters.
Considering the U.S. does not want Venezuela in the U.N. Security Council, particularly on how Venezuela may behave on the issue of weapons of mass destruction and the case of Iran and North Korea, that by the time voting comes around in a few months, it is possible to search for a different candidate.
To do that, analyst Raul Sor says Chile has to work with its regional partners.
In this case, Chile has to look very carefully into the regional balance. Brazil and Argentina have already said that they would support Venezuela getting a seat in the Security Council, and Chile has to weigh very carefully which way it would go.
President Bachelet may help look for a third candidate, or, alongside Argentina and Brazil, put forward Venezuela's candidacy, but under a very short leash in order to maintain regional balance and good relations with Washington. For FSRN, this is Jorge Garretón in Santiago.
The Native Hawaiian Government Reorganization Act has stalled again in the U.S. Senate. The legislation would clarify the political status of Native Hawaiians in relation to the U.S. government. But as it moved closer to a full vote in the Senate, it drew fire from all sides of the political spectrum. Right-wing conservatives believe it gives privileges to one ethnic group over another. Many Native Hawaiian groups feared the bill would ultimately have a divisive effect. Yesterday, seven Native Hawaiian activists in Honolulu occupied the upstairs balcony of Iolani Palace for 3 hours and held a press conference to voice their opposition to the legislation. Anne Kiala Kelly has more.
They hung banners alongside large Hawaiian flags that read, "No Akaka Bill, No Sellout," and "Restore Hawaiian Independence." Speaking through a bullhorn, Kalekua Ka'eo, cultural practitioner and educator, addressed a crowd of about 50 people who gathered to support the action.
Our kupuna said no annexation. We have never given a consent. Yet, we find ourselves today, a so-called elder, Brown Harley, senator, begging on his knees, proudly, begging to be recognized as a native. How embarrassing. How painful. I'm sorry that he doesn't know his history. I wish he did, because he would not grovel to the ground and beg for something that he was born in birthright. We are Kanaka to these lands, Maoli to these lands, O'ivi to these lands, to the Aina, that can never be severed or broken away. We know that. Their game is to make us to forget that.
Ka'eo, along with thousands of Hawaiians, believed that this bill, along with the U.S. presence in Hawaii, is illegitimate because Hawaiians never agreed to the annexation of their country. And because the Hawaiian Kingdom was an internationally recognized nation state, annexation to the U.S. could only have come about through a treaty of annexation, which never occurred. What has occurred in Hawaii, though, since the 1898 takeover by the U.S., has been the buildup of a military arsenal. Again, Kalekua Ka'eo.
We know the truth. Though we may live in probably the most militarized islands in the world, there's no place that has probably more weapons of mass destruction than in Hawaii. And yet, our people are still resisting, still fighting for justice. And that tells me something. Because we'll fight on. As I was taught, the strongest swimmers swim in the roughest seas.
There have been serious concerns raised about the land settlement that would follow passage of the Akaka Bill because of the military in Hawaii. Today, 57% of the land occupied by the military is on what is called ceded lands. That land is the crown and government land of the Hawaiian Kingdom. The Akaka Bill will lead to extinguishment of native title over that land, and many are concerned that doing so could open up more land for the military to expand. Others who oppose the bill, like Moani Akaka, longtime Native Hawaiian activist and former trustee of the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, say this legislation is being directly connected to the dispossession of Native Hawaiians, but not addressing the issues that many Native Hawaiians are faced with today.
Our people end up being strangers in our own homeland. Remember, we are the first peoples of this Aina, and the aloha has been a one-way street. We have given.
Hawaiians being strangers in their own homeland is a reference to the fact that the diaspora rate for Hawaiians is approaching 50%. During the last half of 2005, the average price for a home in some areas went up $250,000. And as the purchase price went up, so did the rental market. And almost overnight, Hawaiians were becoming homeless in large numbers. Over 65% of the homeless people on the most populated islands are Native Hawaiian. There is no language in the Akaka Bill that indicates any attempt to improve the economic status or the physical and psychological condition of the Hawaiian people. As written, the most that Hawaiians can hope to gain from passage of the bill is maintenance of about $70 million per year and federal aid to programs that already exist. For Free Speech Radio News in Honolulu, I'm Anne Kiala Kelly.
The National Commission on Safety and Abuse in America's Prisons presented its findings to a Senate subcommittee today. The commission, the first of its kind in over 30 years, was convened after a growing scandal over conditions in California prisons forced a federal judge to seize control of inmate health care. The National Commission's reports find many of California's problems are present nationwide. They include overcrowding, excessively punitive treatment, widespread violence, health care so poor some inmates die of neglect, and widespread retaliation against whistleblowers. Anastasia Genenziska reports from Washington, D.C.
The Commission on Safety and Abuse in America's Prisons, formed in March 2005, and worked for 1 year to explore the most serious problems inside U.S. correctional facilities. Alex Bozanski, the executive director of the Commission, talks about the major problem with prisons that the Commission has discovered.
Too many in the public do not understand that there are public safety and public health consequences for how we treat people inside of our jails and prisons. All of those people who work in our facilities and the vast, vast majority of who are incarcerated in them are going to be leaving at some point. And they're going to be returning to their families, their neighborhoods, and their communities. And we have to understand that there are consequences for how we treat them inside for what happens on the outside.
The report lists such problems of incarceration as violence, abuse, and inadequate medical care. One of the main themes of the report is inmate isolation and the way the prison system handles it. Timothy Ryan, Chief of Corrections for Orange County, Florida.
There was a concern that the individual should not be immediately returned to the community out of that environment, and there be some sort of transitional environment from that isolated housing to some sort of interim transitional housing within the environment of the institution.
The authors of the Confronting Confinement report were displeased to find out that there is little information available to the public about what goes on inside the prisons. Alex Puzanski.
We don't have enough good information about issues of safety and abuse inside of our jails and prisons. We know that in public schools, compare a public school in San Francisco with a public school in Phoenix, Arizona. We do not have the information to make a meaningful comparison of our prisons and jails from one state to another state, and frequently within that same state. Without adequate knowledge, we can't reward those people and those institutions that are successful, and we can't identify and direct the appropriate resources at those places that are not doing what we want them to do.
Currently, there are 2.2 million people in the United States prisons. 13 million go through prisons annually. The Commission's goal is to draw the attention of the public and congressmen to the conditions inside prisons. The U.S. Senate Judiciary Subcommittee on Corrections and Rehabilitation will receive the Commission's findings and recommendations and hear testimony from five commissioners at a hearing later today. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Anastasia Gnezditskaya in Washington, D.C.
There's new hope at the South Central Farm in Los Angeles, where a group of largely Latino farmers are trying to save their land from being developed into a warehouse. Overnight, word got out that the Annenberg Foundation had joined the effort to raise the roughly $16.3 million necessary to buy the 14-acre farm back from developer Ralph Horowitz. FSRN reporter Kelly Barnes went out to the farm this morning. She says the supporters camped out there are cautiously optimistic.
The Annenberg Foundation is stepping forward to help resolve the issue of ownership for the South Central Farm. The Philadelphia-based foundation has awarded some 5,200 grants, totaling more than $2.8 billion in the past 15 years. And the farmers have known about their interest in the matter for about a week. Today, Leslie Morava, a volunteer media coordinator for the South Central Farm, gave a statement from Dan Stormer, attorney for the farmers, about the recent developments.
Whether or not it was a direct offer, our understanding is that it was told to Horowitz that there are sufficient funds to purchase the property at his asking price. And then TPL statement is, the Trust for Public Land is continuing to work with the seller and private funders to negotiate a transaction to purchase the community farm. The Trust for Public Land is working today on developing an offer to present to the seller.
The Trust for Public Land became involved in brokering a solution when they helped secure a 30-day option to purchase the land, which expired May 22nd. They, along with the Annenberg Foundation and Ralph Horowitz, are in active negotiations over Annenberg's offer of assistance. But exactly what the offer entails is still unclear. Dele Eileman, co-coordinator of the support committee of the South Central Farmers, he's quick to point out that the struggle is by no means over.
Yes, it is true that there were some positive developments on ground yesterday. I would say that we covered an important milestone. One thing I know is that at the level of the supporters, at the level of the volunteers, they remain committed to the process of political mobilization.
Morava speaks to what the news means for the farmers and their supporters.
Honestly, it's going to be up to us to raise the rest of the money. They're not paying for it outright by any means. They're putting enough of money down to try to buy us more time so that we can go into an extended escrow. And then it's up to the farmers and all of us volunteers to raise the rest of the money.
The optimism is palpable at the farm, and Morava expressed gratitude that the South Central Farm succeeded in garnering the interest of the well-established and well-funded Annenberg Foundation. She says getting beyond their vetting of projects on which they were willing to go public was a step in the right direction. For FSRN in LA, I'm Kelly Barnes of People Without Borders.
And a correction. In a story yesterday about Democrats in Congress, we mistakenly identified Senator Joe Biden from Delaware as Senator Carl Levin from Michigan. You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert, sitting in for Out of Bogado.
From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
On behalf of all Americans, I congratulate our troops on this remarkable achievement. Zarqawi is dead.
U.S. and Iraqi officials say Abu Musab al-Zarqawi has been killed in Iraq. We'll speak with Robert Fisk, chief Middle East correspondent for the London Independent, and Italian writer Loretta Napoleoni, author of Insurgent Iraq, al-Zarqawi and the New Generation. Then Army Lieutenant Aaron Watada. He's believed to be the first commissioned officer to refuse deployment to Iraq.
The wholesale slaughter and mistreatment of Iraqis is not only a terrible moral injustice, but it is a contradiction to the Army's own law of land warfare. My participation would make me party to war crimes.
Then Father Dan Berrigan, the lifelong peace activist, has turned 85. We'll look back at his life.
I went into a draft board in Catonsville in May of that year, removed about 300 draft files, and burned them with homemade napalm under the utterly absurd and totally un-American assumption that it is better to burn papers than children.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. and Iraqi officials are claiming Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, al-Qaeda's leader in Iraq, is dead. According to their account, Zarqawi is killed in a U.S.-Iraqi raid near the town of Bakuba on Wednesday. Another seven aides were said to be killed in the attack. Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki said Zarqawi's identity had been confirmed through fingerprints and facial identification. Zarqawi was the most wanted man in Iraq. The U.S. government had placed a $25 million bounty on his head. As leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq, Zarqawi is said to have directed attacks that killed scores of Iraqi civilians as well as U.S. troops. Zarqawi also claimed responsibility for several attacks outside Iraq, including the triple hotel bombings in Jordan last November. Zarqawi's role in Iraq has been the subject of much debate. Some analysts have questioned whether he even exists, while others say his influence has been overblown. Writing on his weblog, University of Michigan professor and noted Middle East expert Juan Cole said, quote, "Leaders are significant and not always easily replaced, but Zarqawi, in my view, has been less important than local Iraqi leaders and groups. I don't expect the guerrilla war to subside anytime soon," Cole wrote. Meanwhile, in Iraq, U.S. troops are being accused of a new round of killings of Iraqi civilians. On Wednesday, the Iraqi Islamic Party, Iraq's main Sunni group, said it had evidence U.S. troops killed more than two dozen Iraqis in incidents last month. According to the group, the most deadly attack occurred in a house in Yusufiya, south of Baghdad, killing 13 people, including women and children. This news on Darfur. The World Food Program is warning innocent Darfurians are growing increasingly hungry as the security situation grows worse. This is World Food Program Director James Morris.
When our people can't get there because they're either denied access or because of security, the people that suffer are those who are displaced and living in strange environments and who have no ability to support themselves on their own. And any time there's a crisis anywhere in the world, these issues always fall disproportionately on the backs of women and children.
A peak in violence has forced the World Food Program to cut its monthly food rations in half last month. In East Timor, looters have seriously damaged an archive containing records of abuses committed by Indonesian soldiers before East Timor's 1999 vote for independence. The looting comes as East Timor is embroiled in an internal conflict between the military and dismissed former soldiers. Last week, looters broke into the offices of the Serious Crimes Unit. According to East Timorese officials, the looters ransacked and stole evidence against scores of Indonesian army officers who've been accused of crimes against humanity. A state prosecutor said nearly all the 99 files are damaged or missing. Here in the United States, an amendment to ban gay marriage has failed in the Senate. On Wednesday, the Senate voted 49-48 to end debate on the proposal, 11 short of the 60 needed to move the measure toward a final vote. Republicans say they'll reattempt to ban gay marriage in the House of Representatives in July. In New Orleans, a new census covering the 4 months following Hurricane Katrina has found the city has become considerably whiter, older, and less poor. New Orleans' metropolitan area has shrunk to more than half its size. The black population has dropped from 37% to 22%, while the percentage of whites has increased from 60% to 73%. In labor news, the newly released annual report of the International Confederation of Free Trade Unions says 115 trade unionists were murdered for defending workers' rights last year. In addition, the group says 1,600 were subjected to violent assaults, 9,000 were arrested, and nearly 10,000 fired from their jobs due to trade union involvement. Colombia remained the most dangerous place to be a trade unionist, with 70 killings last year. At the United Nations, a new conflict is brewing between U.S. Ambassador John Bolton and the staff of U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan. Bolton has threatened consequences due to comments made by U.N. Deputy Secretary General Mark Malik Brown. Brown spoke Tuesday at an event for the Century Foundation in New York.
I hope you will take it in the spirit in which it is meant, as a severe but constructive critique of U.S. policy towards the U.N. by a friend and admirer. Because the fact is that the prevailing practice of seeking to use the U.N. almost by stealth as a diplomatic tool, while failing to stand up for it against its domestic American critics, is simply not sustainable. You will lose the U.N. one way or another.
In response, Ambassador Bolton said the speech was the worst he's heard in decades and said the U.N. may face consequences.
Secretary General Kofi Annan, we think, has to personally and publicly repudiate this speech at the earliest possible opportunity. Because otherwise, I fear the consequences, not just for the reform effort, but for the organization as a whole.
The dispute comes as the UN nears a deadline to enact management reforms by the end of the month. The Bush administration has warned it may reduce UN funding if the deadline is not met. A spokesperson for Kofi Annan said he stood by his deputy's comments. A founder of the internet search giant Google says his company may reverse its decision to launch a censored version of its popular search engine in China. Speaking in Washington, Google executive Sergey Brin said Google was considering the move after coming under heavy criticism for meeting the Chinese government's censorship guidelines. Google's Chinese version bars search results for terms including Tiananmen Square or Falun Gong. And Billy Preston, the prolific keyboardist known as the Fifth Beatle, died on Tuesday at the age of 59. Preston played on several number one hits for the Beatles and Rolling Stones and had 3 number one pop singles of his own. He played at what turned out to be the Beatles' last concert, the famous rooftop performance in 1969. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. and Iraqi officials are claiming Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, al-Qaeda's leader in Iraq, is dead. According to their account, Zarqawi was killed in a U.S.-Iraqi raid near the town of Bakuba on Wednesday. Another 7 aides are also said to have been killed in the attack. The Iraqi Prime Minister, Nouri al-Maliki, said Zarqawi's identity had been confirmed through fingerprints and facial identification. Zarqawi is said to have led attacks on what killed scores of Iraqi civilians as well as U.S. troops. Zarqawi also claimed responsibility for several attacks outside Iraq, including the triple bombings that hit Jordan hotels last November. Zarqawi was the most wanted man in Iraq. The U.S. government placed a $25 million bounty on his head. After the news of Zarqawi's death, President Bush made a statement on the White House lawn.
The operation against Zarqawi was conducted with courage and professionalism by the finest military in the world. Coalition and Iraqi forces persevered through years of near misses and false leads, and they never gave up. Last night, their persistence and determination were rewarded. behalf of all Americans, I congratulate our troops on this remarkable achievement. Zarqawi is dead, but the difficult and necessary mission in Iraq continues. We can expect the terrorists and insurgents to carry on without him. We can expect the sectarian violence to continue. Yet the ideology of terror has lost one of its most visible and aggressive leaders. Zarqawi's death is a severe blow to al-Qaeda. It's a victory in the global war on terror. And it is an opportunity for Iraq's new government to turn the tide of this struggle.
In London, British Prime Minister Tony Blair spoke about the significance of the death of Zarqawi.
The death of al-Zarqawi is a strike against al-Qaeda in Iraq, and therefore a strike against al-Qaeda everywhere. But we should have no illusions. We know that they will continue to kill. We know there are many, many obstacles to overcome. But they also know that our determination to defeat them is total. Their methods, their ideas, their extremism that seeks to infect the overwhelming desire of the overwhelming majority of people, whatever their religion and whatever their nation, to live together in peace and harmony.
And this from the Washington Post. Minutes after Zarqawi's death was announced, the long-debated Interior, Defense, and National Security posts were filled in a giddy session of Parliament. Abdulzakir Mohammed Jassim, a Sunni Arab and former Iraqi army commander, was named defense minister. Jawad al-Balani, a Shiite, was put in charge of the Interior Ministry. And Shirwan Awali, a Kurd, was named the country's top official for national security. For more on the latest, we're joined on the phone by Robert Fisk, Chief Middle East Correspondent for the London Independent, author of a number of books, his most recent, Great War for Civilization, The Conquest of the Middle East. He's on the line with us from Montreal. And on the line with us from Rome, Italy, is Loretta Napoleoni. She is an Italian economist and writer, author of Insurgent Iraq, al-Zarqawi and the New Generation. We turn to you first, Robert Fisk, in Montreal, your response to this latest news about Zarqawi's death.
Well, we've heard so much myth about Zarqawi. I think it's very clear he is dead. At least it's true what we're hearing. But what's very interesting listening to President Bush and Mr. Blair is that they both say, well, the insurgency goes on and there's many more deaths to come and things aren't going to get that much better. It's very good to have these little Hollywood moments, and one shouldn't deny the fact that they exist. But if the insurgency is going to go on, what does this really represent? You see, one of the big problems here is that we keep personalizing in this, there's a French phrase, infantilism, which means babyishness, in this babyish way, you know, well, you know, our horror of the week, the man we hate is, you know, Gamal Abdel Nasser or Ayatollah Khomeini or Osama bin Laden or whoever it may be. The fact of the matter is that I don't think the personalities per se actually make a lot of difference anymore. Someone said to me the other day in Beirut, where I live, you know, they said, oh, well, you know, if they can just get bin Laden, it's the end. And I don't think it is any more than it is with Zarqawi. You know, it's a bit like someone invents the atom bomb, so you go around and you arrest all the nuclear scientists. It doesn't matter. If the atom bomb exists, it's there. That's happened. And what's happened now is that al-Qaeda exists. Whether you destroy or kill Zarqawi, who obviously was an extremely unpleasant person and a killer and perhaps a sadistic killer, whether you kill Osama bin Laden, al-Qaeda exists. The monster is with us. And there are other bigger issues we now have to address. And this constant beating of the breast by the Blairs and the Bushes of this world won't make any difference to that. The only interesting thing, which we didn't used to hear so much of, is to hear these people proclaiming victory and then saying, but the insurgency goes on and there are many terrible things still to come. At least they're preparing us as well as themselves for the fact that this is not as significant a victory as they would claim.
Loretta Napoleoni, your response. Loretta?
Yes?
Your response to the death of Zarqawi and also to Robert Fisk's analysis of its significance.
Yes, sorry, I lost you for a second. The line was not very good. Well, I think, you know, Robert is absolutely right. I mean, killing al-Zarqawi is not going to solve the problem. In fact, to be honest, I think killing of al-Zarqawi is turning this individual into a super martyr, because let's face it, he's the first leader of al-Qaeda who has actually died fighting on the field coalition forces. So tomorrow we'll see the proliferation of the al-Zarqawi brigades, people who want to vindicate the death of the martyr. But I also think that what Robert said is very true about al-Qaeda. In fact, you know, I wouldn't talk so much about al-Qaeda, this so-called transnational armed organization, which existed before 9/11. I would talk about al-Qaedism, which is this new global anti-imperialist ideology, which has been embraced by the jihadists, which has been created from the ashes of al-Qaeda, the transnational organization, through the fight in Iraq, in that al-Zarqawi, a man we created out of nothing, because let's not forget that al-Zarqawi was presented to the world as the link between Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden on February 5th, 2003, when in reality he wasn't for al-Qaeda. So I think, you know, this man has embodied the icon of al-Qaedism, and in death he will be even more powerful than in life. So we have a very long way to win this.
Robert Fisk, I'm looking at a Washington Post piece from a while ago that talked about the Pentagon conducting a propaganda campaign to magnify the role of Zarqawi. Some military intelligence officials believing the campaign may have exaggerated his importance helped the Bush administration make the link between the Iraq war and the September 11th attacks, reportedly used to build sentiment against non-U.S. foreigners in Iraq. One military briefing was entitled, "Villainize Zarqawi, Leverage Xenophobia Response." Another document lists U.S. home audience as a target audience for the campaign.
Yeah, well, you see, this is a war, so you expect to go through this babyish type nonsense. The fact is that the Americans constantly said, you know, Zarqawi is the most evil, wicked, dangerous person in the history of the world, etc., in Iraq. And then they managed to produce the rough cuts of the famous video he made, or the infamous video, in which he couldn't fire an AK-47 and needed help to unlock the new ammunition clip, thus making him to be a fool. So either he's a fool or he's an evil and brilliant carrier out of mass murder. You know, I can't help but remember, because I've been reading recently about the Algerian War, the degree to which the French army kept announcing between 54 and 62 that the killing or destruction or liquidation of FLN leaders meant that there was a severe blow to the terrorist campaign against the French in Algeria. And each time the terrorist campaign or the War of Independence or whatever you like to call it just continued as it did before. The fact of the matter is that it is we, the public, who listen to all this nonsense, who are, in a sense, partly guilty of accepting and allowing people to turn these extremely unpleasant, vicious people into evil monsters of a kind that they don't actually deserve to be, because they are beneath that level. But, you know, this is the nature of war, I'm sorry to say. And, you know, you only have to watch, for example, CNN this morning, as I had the misfortune to have to do here in Montreal, and then to remember, as our colleague rightly says from Italy, that this was supposed to be the link between Osama bin Laden and Saddam, which is complete nonsense. But no one remembers that story now. No one says, but hang on a minute, but hold on a minute. The odd thing is that, you know, we journalists continue to fail to do our job by not challenging the line, the narrative that our authority sets down. We comment upon it, but we don't challenge it. And that's the problem with the whole Iraq war. The fact of the matter is, if you listen to Bush and Blair and those tapes again, as your listeners undoubtedly will on the hour, what they're saying is, this is a tremendous victory and everything will continue to be as bad as it was. That's what this is about, unfortunately.
Loretta Napoleoni, if you could just give us a thumbnail sketch of how Zarqawi rose to power in Iraq, starting in Jordan.
Well, for a start, al-Zarqawi met Osama bin Laden in 2000 in Kandahar. And there was a meeting in which he refused to join Al-Qaeda because he could not share Osama bin Laden's view of the faraway enemy, i.e. the United States. He was very much focused on the existing Arab regimes, in particular Jordan. He managed to carve within the Taliban regime a very little niche, so a little camp in Herat, whereby, you know, he started to train future suicide bombers who will be active in Jordan, Syria. After the fall of the Taliban regime, he escaped in Iraqi Kurdistan because he had some contacts there. And it was because of that, because of his presence there, that the Kurdish Secret Service alerted Al-Qaeda men in Iraq had arrived. And of course, you know, that was a false information. But the information was embraced by the United States because in the moment in which they could not find proof of any weapons of mass destruction, the only chance they had to justify intervention in Iraq was to link Saddam Hussein with international terrorism, i.e. Al-Qaeda. So al-Zarqawi became that link, that fictitious link. And that was sufficient to transform a very small leader of an even smaller group of jihadists into number two member of Al-Qaeda in the world. That is really what made al-Zarqawi. From that moment, not only us in the West, but also people in the Muslim world believed that al-Zarqawi was the number two of Al-Qaeda. So people start flocking to join his insurgency. Money start flowing towards that insurgency. So that was the beginning of the myth. And today we have not at all killed the myth, unfortunately. Because, you know, very easy to create this myth. It's very, very difficult to destroy them.
On that note, I want to thank you very much, Loretta Napoleoni, for joining us, author of Insurgent Iraq, al-Zarqawi and the New Generation, as well as the book Terror Incorporated, speaking to us from Italy. And Robert Fisk, author of The Great War for Civilization, Middle East correspondent for the London Independent, joining us from an airport in Montreal. Have a good trip. This is Democracy Now! Now, when we come back, we're speaking with, well, what we believe to be the first commissioned officer who is refusing deployment to Iraq, First Lieutenant Aaron Watada. Stay with us.
It's coming through a hole in the air from those nights in Tiananmen Square. And it's coming from the field that it ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy's coming to the U.S. It's coming through a crack in the wall, on a visionary flood of alcohol, from the staggering account of the Sermon on the Mount, which I don't pretend to understand at all. It's coming from the sands on the dock of the bay, the brave, the bold, the battered, the heart of Chevrolet. Democracy is coming to the USA.
The Burns Sisters singing Democracy by Leonard Cohen. In just a few moments, we'll be speaking with lifelong peace activist Dan Berrigan. He's turned 85. There's going to be a big celebration for him this weekend in New York. But first, for the first time since the start of the war, a commissioned officer is refusing deployment to fight in Iraq. On Wednesday, U.S. Army First Lieutenant Aaron Watada announced his intention to disobey what he says are illegal orders to deploy to Iraq. He was supposed to make his announcement at a news conference yesterday, but military officials told Watada he could not attend because he's barred from speaking publicly about his case while on duty at the base. Watada is a member of the 3rd Brigade, 2nd Infantry Division, based at Fort Lewis near Seattle and Washington. His unit set to be deployed later this month. month. Lieutenant Watada faces court-martial unless the Army allows him to resign or assigns him to duties not directly connected to the war. On Wednesday, First Lieutenant Watada issued a video recording explaining why he's refusing to fight.
It is my duty as a commissioned officer of the United States Army to speak out against grave injustices. My moral and legal obligation is to the Constitution and not to those who would issue unlawful orders. I stand before you today because it is my job to serve and protect America's soldiers, its people, and innocent Iraqis who have no voice. It is my conclusion, as an officer of the armed forces, that the war in Iraq is not only morally wrong, but a horrible breach of American law. Although I have tried to resign out of protest, I will be forced to participate in a war that is manifestly illegal. As the order to take part in an illegal act is ultimately unlawful as well, I must, as an officer of honor and integrity, refuse that order. The war in Iraq violates our democratic system of checks and balances. It usurps international treaties and conventions that, by virtue of the Constitution, become American law. The wholesale slaughter and mistreatment of Iraqis is not only a terrible moral injustice, but it is a contradiction to the Army's own law of land warfare. My participation would make me party to war crimes. Normally, those in the military have allowed others to speak for them and act on their behalf. I believe that time has come to an end.
That was First Lieutenant Aaron Watada. On Wednesday, he became the first commissioned officer to refuse to fight in the war in Iraq. First Lieutenant Watada joins us now on the phone from Washington State. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
We're also joined on the phone by your lawyer in Washington State, LeGrand Jones, and we welcome you as well.
Thank you.
Well, First Lieutenant Aaron Watada, can you talk about how you arrived at this decision? When did you join the Army?
I signed the papers to join the military in March 2003.
Right at the time of the invasion?
Yes.
And what was your understanding at the time of what would happen?
In terms of the war, I knew that it was probably more than likely that I would be deployed to Iraq. At the time, I didn't believe that the war was fully justified, but I think, like millions of people out there, I believed it when the president and many of his deputies told the world, told the U.S. that weapons of mass destruction did exist, that Saddam had ties to 9/11, and he had ties to Al-Qaeda, and that he had the willingness to use his weapons to attack his neighbors and also the U.S. And so at that time, I had no reason to believe that the president would betray the trust of the people. And so I said that we should give him the benefit of the doubt.
How have you changed over this 3 years?
When I learned that I was going to be deployed last year, I felt it was my responsibility as an officer to learn everything I could about war in general, its effects on people, its effects on the soldiers, and also specifically why we were there, what was occurring at that time, what had occurred in the past, in order to get a better understanding, as it was my job. And the more I read different articles by international and constitutional law experts and the reports coming out from government agencies and non-governmental agencies and the reports and the revelations from independent journalists and the Iraqi people themselves and the soldiers coming home, I came to the conclusion that the war and what we're doing over there is illegal. And so, being so, I felt
This was Democracy Now! You were listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7:30, Ani and Melodies host Positively Revolting Talk Radio. They'll discuss queer issues. At 9 on the Friday radio zine, Joanne Bauman interviews a group of middle school students from Project SOAR. They created a peace project to benefit orphans in Rwanda by providing them with an opportunity for education. They have been invited to present the project to 12 Nobel Prize winners later this year. At 9:30, Dave Mazza interviews Dan Wakefield, novelist, journalist, and a screenwriter whose latest book is The Hijacking of Jesus, How the Religious Right Distorts Christianity, rather, and promotes prejudice and hate. We'll also have commentary from Jay Timmeyer. He'll review the film CSA. And at 10:30, Chris Andre interviews local activist Martha Geis about the future of Patrice Lumumba Ford and the Portland 7. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! Again tomorrow. And now it's 6 o'clock and the time for the Voices of the Middle East.